everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Welcome to another show. You know, it's a beautiful day, and I'm just excited because today we're going to be talking about entrepreneurial success. That's right. It's that Tuesday. I'm sorry, actually, it's that Wednesday. We normally do the show every other Tuesday, but today we've got a special Wednesday edition of Entrepreneurial Success. If you know, if you've been following the show, you know that every other Tuesday we do a show on for entrepreneurs, specifically geared towards entrepreneurs and those who may want to become entrepreneurs. You've considered it, but you know, you've got these wonderful ideas for business and you just don't know how to get them out of your head and to enact them. Well, that's why we do this show, just for you, so that you can have a guide, you can have a compass through which you can navigate the waters of entrepreneurship so that you can successfully reach your destination. You know, my special guest today is going to be Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the awesome book Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. This is the fourth edition. This book just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. We're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle, page by page, so that you, the entrepreneur, can understand when you're making decisions, why you're making decisions, should you make this decision, if so, why so, if not, not. I mean, there is a method to becoming a successful entrepreneur. There are a lot of entrepreneurs, I mean, the statistics are staggering that show the amount of businesses, startups that fail within the first year. You don't want to be in that number. So we're going to tell you about the book. We're going through the book. The plan is that you get the book. You really need the book. I mean, we can cover some of the principles during the show, but when you have the book, it's going to go in depth, going to give you examples that elucidate the principles that we'll be discussing. So you definitely need the book. So I'm going to tell you all about that. But let me first tell you about the author of the book. Professor Joseph Geiger currently is retired. He grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. After his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people succeed in business, he wrote this book, Entrepreneurial Success. It started off with 101 practical business principles, The Road to the Top, and now it's grown to 105 principles. He currently lectures and teaches seminars, and again, he's a fabulous author, not only of this book, but he's written another book, and we'll be telling you how you can get that, and if you listen to additional shows that we'll be doing with Professor, his next book that he wrote was awesome as well, or is awesome as well. It's called Finding a Career for Life, and we'll tell you all about that book and how you could get that book too. But Professor, thank you. First, let me welcome you to the show. Great to have you back. Thank you for being my guest today.
Great to be back. Thank you very much, Juwanza.
Great to have you again. You started off, you know, in your bio, you talk about how you started two businesses prior to graduating from college, and subsequently started over 10 businesses and taught entrepreneurship and business management, and then ultimately became an author. What actually led to you becoming an author? We know this in the bio, of course, you mentioned to help other people, you know, to with their entrepreneurship ventures. But, I mean, was that a difficult task? I mean, just going from teaching it to now writing about it. What was that process like, and what started you to decide, you know, I think I'm gonna write a book on entrepreneurship?
Well, what started me is that after I'd been teaching for a little while, and I kind of got the hang of it, I got the feeling that the people who wrote the textbooks didn't have the kind of basis in actual real life business that I thought they ought to. And then I read their bios and come to find out many of them did not. As a matter of fact, of the 11 or so books that I've used or reviewed for publishers, only one of that 11 was written by somebody who has actually started a business. And frankly, the vast majority of them, I think 9 of the 11 were written by people who never worked in the private sector for anybody. I mean, you know, they didn't even flip hamburgers, nothing. So in teaching and reading the book, I thought that students needed some real guidance very often of things not to do. Because when you do them right, well, you make money and things work out. When you do them wrong, they cost money and they don't work out. And they're the memorable ones. So that's what started me to write the book. And frankly, it really wasn't very difficult once I kind of got decided what I wanted to do was come up with principles. And so I just started writing them down, and I did an outline of what I thought I would cover, the chapter outline. And then as I went through it, I'd think of a principle that I developed and put it in there. So that's kind of how it happened. So it was, and I tried to, one of the other things that in reading the textbooks, they would tell you lots of stuff, but if you ask yourself, how do you execute whatever they said? You know, they said something in the book that said, this sounds really good. Well, how do you actually execute it in practice in the real world? And very often the answer was, well, frankly, you can't. So when you're in business and you have a problem, what you want is a solution that you can actually execute that solves the problem. And if what the solution you have from the textbook sounds real good, but it's not executable, well, then it's worthless. And if it is executable, but it doesn't solve the problem, well, it's also worthless. So, and then I'd read, I have a rather extensive library of business books and frankly outdoor books, hunting and fishing and wildlife and so on. And in reading those books, I found over and over again where people would say, well, you follow these three principles and you get rich. And having done it repeatedly, I knew that was just patently not true. There's lots and lots of situations that you have in business that you have to solve. And so that's kind of the history of why the book was written.
You know, what's interesting is that a lot of people that fall in the statistical side of the businesses that fail within the first year, in many cases, it's probably not due to the fact that they didn't do any research. I mean, some of the people that fall on the statistical side of those that failed may have been readers of one of those books that said, you know, how, you know, three principles or five principles, you can start your own business or whatever. They may have thought that by reading that book or several books, that they would actually increase the odds of their success. And I've noticed that your book is very unique in that it gives real life examples, you know, of the principle at work, you know, and I think that really does make it more real to the reader, you know, when they can see the principle at work. And if they did not understand the principle on its face, then when they read the real life example, then it becomes more alive, and it's like, oh wow, oh okay, I can see that, you know. And I mean, that's why I want to encourage everybody to get this book, because it is very much an enjoyable read. You're learning, and at the same time that you're learning about entrepreneurship, you're learning about a lot of different things too, because it's not just a book about business. It's also a book about business principles that can be used for life, you know. And you'll see as we go through the book, principle by principle, that you can actually use some of these principles for life as well. So, again, during the course of the show, we're going to tell you how you can get the book. We're going to be going through it principle by principle, chapter by chapter. And if you've been following along, you know that we are up to chapter 4, how entrepreneurs view financial statements, how entrepreneurs view financial statements. There are going to be financial statements, everybody. If you're an entrepreneur, you already know it. If you're thinking about becoming one, you might as well get used to that fact. You're going to have to view financial statements. That is going to be a large part of either your success or your failure, meaning whether or not you do that or not. Well, again, under that chapter, there are a lot of different principles, and we're taking them one at a time. We're not rushing through them, so just sit back, get ready to learn, okay? Class is in. The bell just rang, okay? So today we're going to start with principle number 29. Don't be a banker to your customers. Don't be a banker to your customers. Professor, that's a deep, principle there. Could you expound on it?
Yeah, there's a lot of businesses that the business does not loan money to their customer in order to buy the products. But there's a lot of them that do. And everything from a contractor who does the work, whether it's install a light switch in your house or do the electrical or the roofing for the whole house. But there's a lot of businesses that do offer credit, hopefully short-term credit. And it could get away from you. It used to be, when I first started, frankly, up until probably the 1980s or so, that there was no way for somebody to get paid for their service or product other than in cash. But in about the 1980s, credit cards became common, and it's one of the things that you that if you start a business, you need to ask yourself, do I need to be able to accept credit cards? The answer is probably going to be yes, and so you need to find out how you go about doing that. What you do is you talk to your bank, and they will kind of walk you through it, or you can go online and read some stuff about that before you talk to the bank. But the bank is going to be the one who actually does it. So you need to do that. There are some businesses that even today offer credit to their customers. One of them is business to business. So if you wholesale toothbrushes, you're going to deliver dozens of toothbrushes to companies that sell them, and then you'll get paid later. And the way you do that is when you deliver it, you give them an invoice. Normally, most invoices say 10% in the next 10 days, or 100% all of it. Or the way it actually says it is 2% 10 net 30 is the actual wording. And what that means is that you can take 2% off the bill, providing you pay it within 10 days. And if you don't do that, well, then net the entire amount of the bill, for our example here, toothbrushes, in 30 days. So you're hung out to dry for 30 days. And if you don't get your money within 30 days, you need to start fairly aggressively trying to collect. And the reason is that a bill that you have that is less than 30 days old is probably eminently collectible. If it's 60 days old, it might be collectible. And if it's 120 days old, it probably is not collectible. It's probably a write-off. So if you don't follow this up and allow it to get kind of late, you're going to end up being owed money. So essentially what you did is you gave somebody the products or service, and because they're you're a nice guy and they're really terrific people, so you just gave it to them. And you'll never even get reimbursed for any of your costs. So it's important not to allow that. Well, business to business is one. Another is that businesses that supply government, and there the rules are a little different. I learned that when I owned the marina, on a Corps of Engineers lake, and the Corps of Engineers had a boat that they actually they had two boats, and they kept them at my marina. And when I went to the chief engineer there to rent him the space, he said, "Now let me tell you something, that and that is this: if you want to get paid in a timely way, I am part of the United States Army, which is part of the federal government, and that means that if you just give me a bill for the slips, you will be, frankly, very lucky if you get paid in 6 months, and it may be a good deal longer. But there is a way to get paid immediately, and that is to make sure that on the bill you offer 2%, 10, net 30. The net 30, the government isn't going to give a darned about. As far as they're concerned, you could say net whatever you wanted, and they'll get around to paying you whenever they get around to it. But by law, they have to take all discounts offered by merchants. So if you say on your bill 2% net 30, I, by law, have to see to it that you get paid in 10 days. Or my butt is on the line, because that's what the law says. So I personally am responsible to see to it that you get paid. And he just offered me this. And so neither I wasn't going to do that. So I put that in the contract, and whenever I went in and handed him in the bill, I didn't mail it to him. It was easy for me to, because on my way home, I drove right by his office. And so I'd hand it to me, and he would go in and get either cash, or he had a checking account that he could write little checks on. And he'd give it to me right then, so that I couldn't say that I didn't get paid. So that's a second type. Another type is people who sell to very high-end products. If you buy lots of fancy jewelry at Tiffany's in New York, the odds are that you will have an account there. And you or your wife, whoever buys this, they aren't going to ask you to pay it. They will give you a bill, because they will assume that, you know, if you're the type who will walk in there and buy a $50,000 diamond, you can afford it. Now, nowadays, they may give you, they may want if you're a first-timer, they're certainly going to want a credit card. But if you're a standard customer who's in there and buying fancy stuff all the time, you very likely have an account. The other kind is the very low-end buyer, where people come to your little grocery store in a poor neighborhood, and you only have money twice a week, or maybe every Friday is the only time you have money, because what happens when you get paid, you go around and pay your bills. And in that case, they do the same thing. They give you an account. So those are the major ones. So, you know, those are the ways to do it. And I have an example in here about a friend of mine who was a contractor and was building on Highway 5 in California, and he built the interchanges. California ran out of money. They couldn't pay him. They jerked him around. He didn't have the 10%, 2%, 10, net 30 in his contract. And they just didn't pay him, and he finally went bankrupt. And, you know, later on they offered to pay him, but by that time he was bankrupt, and it was all over. And it didn't need to happen. If I'd have known it at the time I knew about that, I would have had to know it before, and when he was contracting with the state of California. And if he'd have had 2%, 10, net 30, he might very well have gotten paid. But where they ran short of money, they just blew him off.
And you know what's interesting about that is that I think the average entrepreneur would feel very lucky to get a contract with the state that they were in, or even any state that they were in, or with the federal government, you know, assuming that, okay, if I land this contract, that they're pretty stable, you know, the odds, you know, jerked around by the government or the state, they probably would feel would be, you know, very slim, as opposed to, mm-hmm. you know, getting jerked around by somebody else. The odds that the state would go broke or not be able to pay them would be, you know, less than the average, you know, business to business, any other business to business type of contract. So I'm sure you've seen it. But even with that, even when it comes to the government or a state, you still got to have that that clause in there, that 10%, that clause you just spoke of.
You know, 2%, 10, that 30. And it needs to be on your contract. It needs to be on your progress payment demands. It needs to be everywhere, so that they can't say that they didn't do it. And you need, if you were going to do it with a state, I know that's part of the feds. If I were going to contract big money with the feds, I'd want to make sure that it's still part of it, but I think it is. And if I was going to do it with a state, I would darn well make sure that that is part of the state government, whereby state law, they have to pay you. And at the time this happened in California, I know it was, because I had sold some airplanes to California, and before I did that, I found out when they wanted to order the planes that I was going to get paid, and I was going to get paid in a timely manner. That's the big problem with government, is that they don't understand timely manner. You know, they don't have any problem with money. Mm-hmm. You know. And although in case of California, they got to the point where they weren't even paying their people, the employees, for about a week and a half or 2 weeks. And for a long time, they gave you IOUs. Well, the banks honored the IOUs for a couple of months, and then they stopped honoring them because, of course, you know, banks are not in the position of lending money without interest, and lending money that is where the loan is upside down. But you need to understand that, and particularly with the government, the people you deal with, they just do not understand cash flow. They don't have a cash flow problem. Certainly the federal government doesn't, because they can just print money, physically print money. Well, you can't. And so cash flow is very important to a business. You may have all kinds of assets. You may have millions of dollars worth of assets, but if you can't pay your people on Friday, you're broke. I don't care whether you have $10 million worth of assets. If you can't pay your bills, you're broke. And you're going to be out of business shortly.
One of the things that you've talked about in the past is being able to speak to the right person, being able to speak to the person that can say yes, not just the person that can say no. And so without me taking the conversation in a totally different direction, as it relates to dealing with state government or the federal government, doing contracts, any tips for someone who is considering, you know, maybe putting in a bid or something, to being able to make sure that you get to the right person, because this is going to be and can be a very, it could be complex. And just getting to make sure that you're speaking with the decision maker, that person that can say yes to whatever it is that you need them to say yes to, and not just the gatekeeper who can say no but has no power to say anything other than that.
Well, it depends upon what the kind of contract is. If you are bidding on a bid request from the state or the feds, all you can do is just put your damn bid in. Now, you know, I've only done that a couple of times, but so I'm certainly not an expert at it. But I think basically that's the only thing you can do is put your bid in. And do it the way they say it, do it in a timely fashion, make sure it gets there a couple of days before the the drop dead date, and and that's about all you can do. Now, if you're trying to do something different, for example, I tried to sell some airplanes to the state of California, and so where I started with is the guy in charge of one of the one of California's air depots, where there was a guy in charge of the flying the airplanes for the state. Well, what I found out pretty quickly is he could say no, he couldn't say yes. If he said yes, it didn't mean anything because he couldn't write a check. So what I finally did in that circumstance is find out who the heck can write the check and start with them, because everybody else below them can say no, but they can't say yes. And if they say yes, it doesn't mean anything. So go to the person who can actually write the check. And that's worked out pretty well for me with businesses too. You know, don't go to the person on the low end of the totem pole. If you possibly can, talk to the president of the company, who can, if you can convince that person, well, then you can get a contract and you can get a check. So that's kind of simple, and I believe that with all my heart in everything I do. So if I wanted to pitch an idea at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College on a new class, at minimum, I would start with the dean of the business school. But probably I would try to get to the president of the business school, of the whole school, not the business, but the president of the college. Because if you can get the president of the college on your side, good old Deanie is going to say, yes, sir, right away, we'll do it, sir. If he's talking to me, he can jerk my chain, he can do whatever. It's a terrible idea, and, you know.
One of your other principals, guy, professor, could come into play, which is what's the downside, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there is no downside. If the president says no, you can always start down below and work yourself back up. But usually what happens when you go to the president, they'll say, well, go see Mr. Smith or Ms. Smith, and she'll be the one. And then my next one is there a way, Mr. President, that the three of us can have a meeting? If he's already said yes. If there is, boy, that's the way you want to go. Because if there's any possible way, you want to make sure that the person who can write the check is in on the negotiation to do it.
Good point. That is an excellent point. That way he can hear or she can hear for themselves and doesn't have to go by the recommendation or have your words filtered through the the third person in the meeting.
Yeah, and you can, if the third person, the one in the middle that the president tells you to go see, if they don't want to do it, they don't necessarily need to tell the president the true story. They can filter the story any darn way they want to. And you could get blown out because they come and say that it's going to cost $1 million when you in fact said it was going to cost $453,000.
I was going to say that actually reminds me of something. It's a bit different, but it's the principle is the same. I remember there was somebody that I actually wanted to interview, okay, and the person's assistant. You know, I'd ask the person's closest assistant, you know, would this person be open and interested in doing the interview? And the person said, well, I don't think so. You know, she's really, really busy. She's got a lot of stuff going on right now, and I don't think that she would really have the time or whatever. I said, well, would you ask her anyway? So she said, sure, I'll ask. And then she came back to me and said, you know, I asked her. She said she would have loved to have done it, but she just can't find the time in her schedule to do it. And I was like, okay, well, thank you. But then I ran into the lady that I wanted to interview somewhere else, and I said, And I said, you know, I'm really sorry, you know, that you wouldn't, you know, won't be able to do the interview because, you know, I was really, you know, hoping to, you know, help you to promote your work. She was like, what interview, Juwanza? I said, you know, the interview that so-and-so, didn't she tell you about the interview I've been trying to pitch to you?
Nope.
She was like, my first time hearing anything about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The first time, that was the first time she had heard anything about it. Obviously,
yep.
The person, by the way, she loved the idea. She did the interview, not only did an interview, but came out and did a personal appearance. I mean,
yep.
Wow, it was just great. But she had no idea because I had pitched it to a third person, somebody
right.
else, thinking that they were going to, you know, promote it to the person that I was trying to reach, and
mm-hmm.
I learned a very valuable lesson there.
Yeah.
Hopefully
you always remember that, so the next time you don't even bother with that person, you go direct.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's true of all kinds of things. When you're trying to raise money the same way, you go to the person who can write a check. You don't ask them to write a check right now. You give them a executive summary, and you try to pin them down on an exact time when you can meet. So if you saw them on a Wednesday, you say, well, how about next Friday when things are at 2 in the afternoon at your
mm-hmm.
office? And so that, you know, and that's the way to do it. Start with the top and work down. Don't start with the bottom and work up. Everybody at the bottom can say no, but nobody can say yes, and a no is final. As you go up the ladder, a yes is never final. So you got to.
And you know what, Professor? Sometimes even the person who you're pitching the idea to, even if you come back and say, "How about next Tuesday at 2:00 at your office?" They might be impressed just by your nerve. You know,
yep.
just by
yep.
the fact that you had the nerve to do it. You know, just the fact that you had the nerve to come straight to the top. You know, you ever thought
right.
about that?
Well, yeah, because you're organized.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who run things or run offices or businesses like people who are organized, and you're organized. So, sure.
Everybody, we're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. This is the fourth edition. This is the book that just keeps on growing and growing and growing and growing. And we're up to principle now number 30. Collect delinquent accounts with candy, not a club. Collect delinquent accounts with candy, not a club. Professor?
Okay, that one is what happens when the normal way that people collect delinquent accounts. Well, normally what happens is a nasty letter is sent, and then when the nasty letter that is sent doesn't work, you send an even nastier. Well, probably what you do is you start with a phone call, and then when that doesn't work, you send a collection letter. And when that doesn't work, either the next time or shortly thereafter, you turn it over to collection. Well, think about who you're talking to. The guy who can't pay you very likely can't pay others. So when you go to him and say, if you don't pay me, I'm going to sue you, their immediate reaction is, well, get in line, pal, because there's five in front of you and two more behind. So I don't care. So, and then let's say that you actually, your attorney actually collects it. So we'll call it $100. If it's if it's $100, the attorney bill will be $400. So that doesn't work out very well. If it's $1,000, the attorney will take a third to half, and you'll get the other half, which probably isn't enough to even pay for the product, the wholesale on the product.
Mm-hmm.
That is a bad deal. So my way of doing it is very much different. You go to the person who owes you and you say, look, you have bills, I have bills, I understand that it's tough for you to pay me. And I would like to get paid, but I understand that for you to pay me right now, basically you're going to have to decide who you're not going to pay in order to pay me. So why don't we do this? Why don't we the next time you want to buy something, you pay for it, And then we add 10% more. So if you buy $100 worth of merchandise or service, products or service, you write me a check for $100, $110. And the $100 pays for whatever you're getting, and the $10 goes on your account. Now, you can probably handle the $10, but you can't handle the $4,000 you owe me.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll just do it this way. And there's no interest. We're not going to get all involved in interest and that sort of thing. So what can you – how would that work? And I have had excellent luck with that, absolutely excellent luck, where people do pay. And what happens is you make a friend, because these guys who are not able to pay you, very, very seldom are they not able to pay you because they want to stick you. They just mm-hmm. don't want to. The reason they are not able to pay you is because they financially cannot. So you're giving them a way that they financially can. At the same time, you are going to help out their credit, because their credit sucks, being as how they can't pay you and they can't pay anybody else. So their credit is really in terrible shape, and you're helping them out. So what happens is that you make a friend, and everybody else makes enemies. If you say, if you don't pay me, I'm going to sue you, you've made an enemy. Now, I don't care when people say, well, why, I'm not the bad guy here. I'm not the one who cannot pay the bill. Why am I all of a sudden the bad guy and the enemy? Well, I'm not teaching a psychology class here. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. And so what you want to do is not make an enemy. Let's make a friend. And so you make a friend, and you teach them how to get their credit back. So once you do that, then what I've done is I teach them how to get a credit card. And they say, well, I can't get a credit card because I am upside down with everybody. So you say, well, actually, you can get a credit card. You just can't get a credit card with a $5,000 limit. You can get a credit card with a $200 limit. So you get your $200 credit card, and I'll help you do it. I won't sign for you, but I will vouch for you that you've done business with me and you paid your bills, which you have. Now, admittedly, it's late and we had to do that, but we don't want need to. That's not our deal. That's not my deal to tell everybody how you're a late pay. You're a slow pay. You paid your bills. So you get you help them get a $200 credit card. And then you say what you do is you go use that credit card to buy whatever you want. And as soon as you do it, within 10 days, you pay it off. And you keep using it over and over again. And within 10 days, you pay it off. There's no interest because you paid it off long before it was due.
Mm-hmm.
And so you pay it off. And pretty soon, you'll find that your $200 credit card is $400 and then $800. And shortly, it's a $3,000. And if you want it to be more, you can do that. So you teach them how to do that. And then you also teach them that the way you can use the credit card as a truly a interest-free loan is pretty simple. Credit cards have due dates. So you get a credit card that starts, you get it on the first of the month. Well, on the end of that month, they will send you a bill. The bill is not due normally immediately. The bill is due before the end of the next month. And if you pay the credit card 100% before the bill is due, there is no interest. If you pay it one day after the bill is due, there is interest. So you can get a loan for, to start with, $200, which is interest-free. All you got to do is always, always pay it before it is due. And then if you want to get really complex, what I've done for years, and I do it today, I have three credit cards. One is due on the 1st. One is due on the 15th or the 10th. And the third one is due on the 20th. So I use the first one from the 1st to the 10th, and then I stop using it. I use the second one from the 10th to the 20th, and I stop using it. And the third one from the 20th to the 30th, and I stop using it. Now, the first one, which I use from the 1st to the 10th, I will get a statement sometime about the 6th or 7th of the following month, and it will be due usually before the 1st of the following month. So I use it from the 1st to the 10th. I got a bill on in January, and on February the 6th, I got a bill for it, how much it was, statement. But the bill is not due the day I get it. They give you 20 or so days, 20 or 30 days to pay it. So let's say they give you 30 days, and it is due on the 30th of February. So on the 28th of February, on the 28th of February, so it's due on the 26th of February, I pay it on the 26th, 2 days before it's due. And I pay it online so I know it's paid. Don't use the mails, because with a mail service, you don't know whether your check actually got there.
True.
So you pay it 2 days before it's due. Now think about this. I essentially borrowed money from the 1st to the 10th of January. Let's say I bought $1,000 worth of stuff. I pay it on the 26th of February. I pay for $1,000 worth of stuff, no interest. I had a loan, an interest-free loan, for a month and a half, a little over a month and a half. And I do the same thing on the second card and the third card. And when I was in business, we would very often have $50,000, $60,000 worth of merchandise on those three cards and didn't pay a penny of interest.
Wow.
So it's like you were getting a $50,000 loan that was totally interest-free.
But the caveat is you got to pay it back before the due date.
In full. When they say, well, you only have to pay $25, no, sir, you do not have to pay $25. You have to pay it in full. And if you do that, there's no interest, and your credit score will go through the roof. It'll be so high. I mean, I know people who started out with a 500 credit score, and within 2 years, they were at 805, 810, and climbing. And that's how they did it.
I guess the trick here would be just make sure that you do not borrow, for lack of a better quote unquote, more than you can pay back.
Yep.
Within that time frame.
That's right. So if you have to go to the bank and let's say you owe $1,000 but you only have $800, if you have to go to the bank and borrow $200, do it. Because the interest rate is, the normal interest rate on these things is sinfully high, and you're doing it on a revolving deal, and it's like that 2% 10 net 30. Paying the 2% in 10 days is actually, if you figured it all out, it works out to a 36% interest that you were avoiding. So
wow.
It's very high, yeah. And this is even worse because you're not talking about 2%. You're talking usually about 15 or 18 or more percent.
Good point.
And all you got to do is make sure you have to pay it in full. And if that means that you don't get a paycheck for a few days, so be it. But you must pay it in full. And if you do, your credit card score will go through the roof.
Interesting. There are a lot of caveats there, though. Again, do not purchase more than you can afford, that you can pay back in full. Not
in full.
Pay most of it, you know, because if you pay most of it, you're going to pay interest.
That's right. That's right. You will pay interest. So if you owe $1,000 and you pay $900, you'll pay interest.
Wow, that's a very good tip. That's worth the price of the book alone, Professor.
It frankly is definitely, that's true.
You know, well, let me ask you about one more way that, and I don't recall it being discussed in the book, settling. You know, there are times when people, businesses, are even willing to take less than what is owed just to get something, you know. So let's say, for example, somebody does not have to do business with you again, and that's the reason why they figure, well, I can take a chance and settle, because if they say no, I'll just say, okay, well, they won't get anything, and I'll just go purchase whatever I need to purchase from somebody else.
Right.
So if somebody comes and says, you know, hey, I know I owe you $1,000, but I got $250, and that's all I got. You know, you can have it if we can call this thing even. You know, would you as a of course, as a the person with the $250, be like, yeah, great deal. But for the person that is owed the $1,000, it's not necessarily a good deal. But if you're against the wall and saying, like, it's the $250 or nothing, what do you do?
Well, I would try my scheme. Instead of that, I would say, look, why don't you pay me $100? And what do you need to buy? And you probably need to buy a bunch of stuff. So, you know, you're putting that off. Why don't you buy the stuff you need to buy? And then you buy $200 worth of stuff and you pay me $220. So I'll put $20 against the $1,000 that you owe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can stay in business. And but I really need for you to keep coming back, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to take it to collection. There's no percentage in that. Nothing for it's a bad deal for me. It's a bad deal for you. It's just a bad damn deal. So why don't you buy $200 worth of stuff and pay me $220? You still have $30 for lunch and stay in business. And that's what I would try. Because you're going to have, you have a chance. My experience has been so good with that I would suggest that 9 times out of 10, their eyes are going to light up and they think, wow, I came here thinking that I was going to take my last $250 that I have right handy, and away it goes. And here this guy is offering to keep me in business and keep me going. So that's the way I would do it.
Okay.
And that's worked for me extremely well.
You know, just even as we're having these discussions, there are a lot of different creative ways that you can do things to get what you want and, you know, not lose a customer. To help somebody, like you mentioned, even with the credit card, to help them get a credit card, reestablish their credit. You keep a friend for life, a customer for life, and you know, just gotta be creative. It's not just always either, you know, I don't have it, you know, when it comes to it, I don't have it, you gotta sue me, or I'm gonna sue you because you don't have it. You know, there are a lot of different creative ways, and that's why, again, this book, everybody get it, because it's, again, 105 of these principles, 105. We're just up to 30, okay? And we're going to cut it here for this week in terms of the principles. I'd like Professor to talk about his other book, Finding a Career for Life, but we'll be picking up next time in 2 weeks on Tuesday. We'll start back with Dead Assets Are Deadly. Dead Assets Are Deadly. Oh, they sound deadly.
Yep, they are.
They sound deadly. But, Professor, again, and let's tell people how first they can get this book, and then tell them about the other book that you've written, Finding a Career for Life, but I know that there are people that are interested in getting this book. Again, it's full of 105 business principles with examples, so that, you know, again, if you don't get the principle when you read it, you'll definitely understand it by the time you finish reading the example. How can people get your book?
Well, you can get it either at Amazon, and if you go to Amazon, type in the book section when you're looking for books, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. And you need to put the 105 Business Principles in, because there's all kinds of entrepreneurial success books. But if you do put those two things in, there you got it. If you go to just the web and ask for theroadtothetop.com, you'll find it there. In both cases, the price is the same. The only difference is that I sign the ones that people get asked, you know, come to me for. But the book's the same. And the other book I wrote is available both places, and it is Finding a Career for Life. And it's basically a little book. It's only about less than 80 pages, but it's full of data on what careers are doing in the country. Now, I don't take any position on whether you ought to go to college or you ought not to, or anything. That you ought to get a bachelor's or a PhD or no college at all. I really don't care. The only thing I care about is that whatever your choice is, you do it with facts. One of the fundamental principles on making decisions is decisions should be data-driven. So this little book has lots and lots of data in it. And it's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's from College Score. The College Score .ed.gov. It's the federal government's on which college to go to. There's quite a number of the charts in there, that are from payscale.com, which is super because this is actual real. This is what what people are really paid. And it's not only how much money does a particular career make, but it also has in it a lot of information on whether the people who have that career like it. So, for example, I fully thought when I did this that nurses would be very proud of their nursing career. But I also thought that people who were computer geeks and really into computers, they would really love that too. Well, it turns out I was right on the nurses and wrong on the computers, because the computer people who actually have had those kind of jobs for years and years are not particularly proud of them. And others are. Other kinds of jobs are. And all of this information is there. And the sources are also there. So if you decide, I don't really trust this Geiger guy, maybe he just made all this stuff up, you can type in one of the websites and go right to it, and boom, there it is. This is where I got it. I just went there, and I copied and pasted. So I didn't type any of it. Now, I typed some information on how to interpret it that will be helpful, but I did not type, I did not make up any of this stuff. And as I said, I don't care. I'm not trying to sell college. I'm not trying to sell non-college. I'm not trying to sell anything. I'm just trying to give people information. The little book is less than $10. The Entrepreneurial Success is about $18, and so they're not very expensive. The Finding a Career for Life, for me, the only downside is that every year I have to redo it. because I feel pretty strongly in that I ought to be given the latest information. And you will find there's all kinds of information. One area is what is the best cities to go to, because if you want to be an accountant, what's the best city to go to? And if you want to be a petroleum engineer, where is the best city to go to? All of that information is there.
Of accountants, how did they fall on the list of enjoyable, those that enjoyed their work? That seems like another group that would probably enjoy doing what they do. You know, accountants, like I would have thought, like you, that those who were computer geeks would really love their work. Did accountants, do you recall what that their level of enjoyment was when it came to their work?
No, I really don't. I mean, because there's on that list, there's 460 some different that. So there's lots and lots of them. I remember the petroleum engineer just because they're financially so successful, and they are proud of what they do, but they're not anywhere near nurses. I mean, it's still pretty good, and you can look at that and say, yeah, I think I'd take that. Looking at that, it's not one of those jobs that I'm gonna, after I've been at it for 3 or 4 years, I'm gonna say to myself, I don't care how much this sucker pays, I'm out of here.
Right.
But where is the most money? And for a 4-year degree, by far, the best is petroleum engineering. I mean, the average midterm, midlife income for that is right at $180,000. And there is not a PhD, there is not another career choice that you can make other than in medicine that's even close to $180,000 midlife. Not even close. So I don't care whether you get a PhD in chemical engineering, you're not even close to what a bachelor's in petroleum engineering is going to make.
So, you know, even just briefly in the last couple of moments, just talk about the petroleum engineer. I mean, because there may be people that have the aptitude for that. There may be people that, you know, could really, I mean, they have the intelligence, they could do it, but is the petroleum engineer going to be out there on the, I don't know what that machine is, you know, that's going to be out there drilling or whatever. And let's say if this person that has the aptitude for it is a city person, but now there are no city jobs for petroleum engineers, they might have to move to Montana somewhere. You know,
yep.
So
well,
I guess
that,
you got to kind
of
wait.
All part of that's all part of the deal. Is when you see this doesn't mean being a petroleum engineer is not for everybody. If you grew up in New York City and you want to live in a big city, then that one's not going to work for you. I mean, it's just that simple. So, but you know, you can find something that is. I grew up on a farm in Kansas, so being a getting an MBA to be an accountant or a manager for a Fortune 500 firm probably means that I'm not going to live on a Kansas farm or a farm anywhere.
Right.
I'm going to have to live in a big city. And if a big city is not for me, well, then what do I even want to think about getting an MBA in business for? I mean, that makes no sense at all. So it gives you the basic information, and then you need to make the decision on what you want to do. But what I hate to see is particularly young people who spend 4 years getting a degree in sociology and then come to find out there are no jobs for people with a bachelor's degree in sociology. And they're not.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't any.
Mm-hmm.
So here you got it. Your professors all said, boy, this is going to be great for you. You'll get out of here and you'll get a $100,000 a year job as a sociologist. Well, not really. If you got a job for $40,000 a year for a sociologist, you hit a home run. And probably you'll find no job for it. So the statistics show that half of all the graduates from four-year colleges, 6 months after they graduate, over half do not have a job that requires any kind of college degree, anything. In other words, they're flipping hamburgers. So they spent 4 years of their life, God knows how much debt they have, and they have no job. They cannot pay their debt. They probably can't buy a car. There's no way they can get married and support a family, all because they got a degree in something that has no future. And I could have told them that. My little book could have told them that a year before they started in college.
And then when you throw in, Professor, the fact that, as you mentioned in a previous show, that what is the percentage of the people who at some point in their working life become entrepreneurs? So they need both books, you know. They need to get the book on finding a career for life and the 105 Business Principles Entrepreneurial Success, because at some point statistics show that a large majority of people who are at some point in their working life will become entrepreneurs, right?
Well, these are the statistics that, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and this is as of 2010, essentially, over a third, almost 40%, of all people who have income, who make income, have jobs, over a third of them will be entrepreneurs at some point in their life. Of those who have a four-year college degree, over half will be entrepreneurs at some point in their life.
Wow. You see why, everybody, you came to the right show. You need both of these books. You need Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, and you need Finding a Career for Life, both by Professor Geiger. TheRoadToTheTop.com, if you go there, that'll get you there. And, Professor, I want to thank you for the information that you shared in both of these books, because they are so impactful. And I can really, and again, I want to impress upon people, the Finding a Career for Life, you need to get that for your high school student. Okay, so that because the decisions that they make and decide whether or not they're going to go to college, and if they do decide to go to college, what they're going to take, that decision alone can impact the rest of their life in either a positive way or in a way that has them looking back with regret. So definitely get both of these books. Professor, any parting words for our listeners today? Great show.
Well, not really. Get both of them, and particularly the Finding a Career for Life for young people. If you have a young person in your family who is a junior or a senior in high school, for goodness sakes, get it so that they can start making an informed decision instead of doing what over half of all college graduates do, is they make uninformed decisions, and they don't find out how bad the decision was until they're eyeball deep in debt. They've spent 4 years studying something that has no future. And frankly, the vast majority of college majors have a very limited future. Now,
wow.
You don't have to be a petroleum engineer, but you got to do something that has a future.
Mm.
And this book will tell you what are the fastest growing jobs and what are not. What are the slowest?
That decision can impact your life in a very meaningful,
It will. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the one thing we can say tonight, that every high school kid, who whatever decision they make, is going to impact the rest of their life.
Everybody, awesome, awesome show. You see why you tuned in today. Now, you know you can go scroll down the archives and you'll see Professor Geiger. He's a regular. He comes on every 2 weeks, normally on Tuesday. So if you scroll down the archives, you'll see other shows where you see entrepreneurial success. Just click that. That will be another show with Professor Geiger. We've done shows on finding a career for life. Those shows are in the archives as well. And you owe it to yourself and you owe it to the people that you know and love, that you really care about, to share this information with them. Don't try to remember what he said. Just share the link, and that way they can hear for themselves. Professor Geiger, great show. I'll be looking forward to talking to you again in 2 weeks.
Bye for now.
All right. Take care, everybody. That is Professor Joseph Geiger, again, author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. It's the fourth edition. This book just keeps growing and growing, and I guarantee you, if you get this book, you're going to love it. I don't recommend books lightly, but again, there are a lot of people out there that are entrepreneurs, and you don't want to be in that number of people whose businesses fail within the first year. You don't want to be in that number. And there's a way to avoid it. You want to stack the odds in your favor, right? Professor Geiger has been doing this for over 50 years. He's been an entrepreneur for over 50 years, longer than many of you who are listening to this show right now have been born, okay? Started over 10 businesses, has taught entrepreneurship and business on the collegiate level, okay, and has written a book with over 100 business principles, 105 to be exact, okay, with examples. So if you don't just get the principle, he gives you an example on how to apply the principle, okay? There's a way to do everything. There's a right way, which unfortunately far too many people don't do, and that's why so many businesses fail within the first year. And there's a wrong way. You want to increase the odds that you're going to be successful. One of the ways you do that is to listen to someone who has been successful in whatever the situation is. You want to listen to those that have done it and have been successful doing it, right? Well, one way you can increase the odds that you'll be successful at business is to have a map, to have a guide. They're going to be more than 10 different things that come up in business. You might, in business, come up with your own principles, okay? These are his 105. These are 105 things that Professor Geiger has seen that he's decided to share so that you don't have to experience those things the way he had to experience them. Also, Finding a Career for Life, I've read that book as well. Awesome book with a lot of statistics, you know. One of Professor Geiger's principles is all decisions should be data-driven. The decisions that you make should be based on facts. Facts, facts, and more facts. I just had a thought, but I won't go there. You know what, everybody? Thank you so much for your time. Again, you could be doing anything. But the fact that you've tuned in today to listen to this show means that we're on the same page. Okay, so again, if you have an entrepreneur in your life, you know of someone that is interested in becoming one, or even if you are one, and even if you're successful, you can always learn more. So I encourage you to get the book. My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. Professor Geiger will be back in 2 weeks. And until then, everybody, I wish you nothing but much, much, much success. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.